guardian.co.uk.
Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the first of our New Look Daily News podcasts. It's Monday, February the 11th. Today, the Archbishop of Canterbury faces senior Church of England clerics for the first time since his controversial comments on Sharia law. We hear from some of his flock.
I certainly don't agree that we should be adopting Sharia law.
Lord Ashcroft, the Deputy Tory Chairman and a major party donor, is under pressure to reveal the full extent of his tax arrangements. And an apology to the forgotten generation of Aboriginal children taken from their parents.
We lost our culture, we lost our identity, we lost our families, we lost our heritage. We actually lost everything.
Guardian Daily with Matt Wells on guardian.co.uk.
That's all coming up later. First, though, a summary of the day's main news.
I'm Sandy Waugh. The Archbishop of Canterbury is expected to improvise a speech to the Church of England's National Assembly to directly address the controversy sparked by his comments on Sharia law. Last week, he raised suggestions the possible adoption of some aspects of Islamic law in Britain. In his original speech, he'd wanted to speak about the political turmoil in Zimbabwe. Officials have now advised him the intense media interest should now be challenged head-on. We'll have more on that in just a moment. Rebels have shot the president of East Timor. José Ramos Horta has undergone surgery to his stomach after soldiers opened fire on his official residence. The Nobel Peace Prize laureate has been taken to an Australian military base. His condition is not known. A 23-year-old woman's due in court following the evacuation of a North Sea oil rig. Following reports of a bomb, a huge emergency operation was launched yesterday involving the Army, RAF and police. According to one report, the scare began after an employee was overheard talking about a dream she'd had. Attacks on fire crews are increasing. According to union leaders, it's becoming a recreational practice. Their report is rejecting official government figures which show a fall in violence. The Fire Brigades Union is demanding better protection, saying its members regularly face being ambushed, shot at and stabbed. And the BAFTAs have defied the bookies. Many had been predicting it would be Atonement's night. Yet, despite its 14 nominations, it came away with only two awards, although one of those was Best Film. Best Actress went to Marion Cotillard for her performance in La Vie en Rose. The French Edith Piaf biopic picked up most trophies with four. Daniel Day-Lewis was named Best Actor for his role in There Will Be Blood. In this morning's papers, the Mail leads with warnings of a blackout, saying councils are being forced to switch streetlights off after midnight to save cash. The Independent's front page pictures a man known as Cambodia's Himmler. It says he was Pol Pot's henchman and he goes on trial soon. According to The Express, a migrant is arrested every 4 minutes in Britain. The Telegraph then reveals more than 2 million foreigners are working in the UK. The Sun claims RAF experts have heard fighters in Afghanistan talking with Brummie and Yorkshire accents. Its front page headline is Tally Brum. There's more on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
The storm clouds swirling around the cassock of the Archbishop of Canterbury are showing no signs of abating. He was said to be in shock at the weekend, astonished at the level of reaction to his comments about Sharia law and how it might be recognised by the legal system in Britain. The speech was delivered in language so opaque that it rather defies summary, and into that vacuum has been poured a hefty dose of vitriol. This week, Dr. Rowan Williams faces the General Synod of the Church of England. Will his critics voice their concerns, or will it be ecclesiastical business as usual? We'll hear from a Synod member in a moment, but first to Bath Abbey, where Stephen Morris spoke to worshippers yesterday.
I'm sorry for him, in a way, but I think that a man in his position should know better.
Do you think he should consider his position now?
It seems a little extreme to demand resignation. After all, politicians don't resign for things far worse.
If, as I think he was saying, is that one could possibly look at what Sharia law says and maybe adopt some of that into the life of our multicultural society, then possibly I agree with that. I certainly don't agree that we should be adopting Sharia law in this country because it's not part of our culture.
That's the word from the pews. On the line now is the Reverend Giles Fraser. He's the Vicar of Putney and he's also a member of the General Synod. The General Synod is meeting today, Reverend Fraser, and Rowan Williams is giving an address. Do you think that he needs to raise this issue?
I don't know about needs to, but I think he probably will. I think he'll say something
Whether that keeps the whole thing going or whether it quietens it down, I'm not sure.
What do you think he needs to say?
I just think he needs to clarify for people what it is that he was and he wasn't saying. I think this whole issue needs to be spelt out quite a lot for people. I think a word like Sharia has a sort of immediate impact, and it's very unfortunate that's the case. But I think Rowan Williams needs to say that he wasn't advocating any of the darker sides of Sharia, which I think a lot of people know, but I think he needs to keep on saying it.
Do you think he was right to raise the issue, or perhaps a little naive?
Or brave. Maybe that's the third option. I mean, the fact that he raises this issue in full knowledge that perhaps that there's going to be a storm and a backlash, but actually feels the need to raise it anyway. I mean, people aren't talking about things like this. People are afraid of things like this. And I actually think it's rather courageous of him to raise this debate. Perhaps it wasn't the best way in which to do it. And I have to say also that I actually disagree with him about what he said about it. Nonetheless, I think I couldn't think of a better person to kick this off in a sort of wise and gentle way. I think that there's been problems doing it through this this rather convoluted legal lecture. But I think it's a good thing that this has happened.
There have been a few calls from one or two of your fellow Synod members, actually, for him to resign. Do you think we should take those calls seriously at all?
No, they're from the usual suspects. It's an extremist fringe. They'd call for his resignation, whatever he said. In fact, they're using this particular issue as a sort of an excuse to stick the knife in, and they wanted to stick the knife in for ages about a whole range of issues. Mostly it's about homosexuality. You'll find that all these people who are calling for his resignation are people who think he's too liberal on that subject.
I was going to bring that up. I mean, whether it is women priests or gay bishops and now this, it does seem that the Anglican Church does have a bit of a capacity for getting its dog collars in a twist.
Well, the Anglican Church is a remarkable organisation in that it is a very broad church, by definition. I mean, when it was set up, it was there to stop religious wars by being incredibly inclusive. There isn't a church that is as comprehensive, as Catholic, as it were, as the Church of England. And precisely because of that, we fight a lot with each other. But what is its vice is also its virtue, because it's such a broad tent.
Reverend Fraser, thanks very much. And there's plenty more on the debate on the Archbishop at commentisfree.co.uk. Elsewhere on Guardian.co.uk today, you can check out who was wearing what at the BAFTAs last night at Guardian.co.uk/film. We have news that the US government wants air marshals on every transatlantic passenger flight from Europe. That's at Guardian.co.uk/world. Reports and reaction from the two big games in the Premiership, some dramatic Six Nations rugby, and the final of the African Nations Cup at Guardian.co.uk/sport. Barack Obama's challenge for the White House received a substantial boost over the weekend with decisive victories over Hillary Clinton in primaries in Washington State, Louisiana, and Nebraska. The wins mean that the two Democratic Party candidates are now neck and neck. The Guardian's Ewan McCaskill is in Washington, D.C., which has its primary tomorrow. He says it's been a big weekend for the Obama camp.
Yeah, Barack Obama was expected to win these contests, but the surprise was the scale of them. He won two of the big ones by margins of 2-1, and that's a huge setback for the Clinton team. In some ways, people didn't think this weekend would be particularly significant, but I think when people look back on it, they will realise there was a big sort of psychological shift this weekend, and with the advantage going to Obama.
It looks increasingly likely, Ewan, that the Democratic race will be decided at the party's convention in August, and not by ordinary delegates, but by these superdelegates. What can you tell us about them?
Well, there's 4,049 delegates in all. Of those, 796 are superdelegates. They're members of Congress, governors, and the sort of aristocrats of the party, you know, Bill Clinton and people like that. And they have an automatic right to attend conference and to vote. At present, Hillary Clinton has an advantage over Barack Obama there. About a third of those 796 have said how they're going to vote, and Hillary has an advantage. But the other two-thirds haven't. They're waiting to see how the race turns out. So the battle behind the scenes now will be for those sort of two-thirds who are undeclared. And that's going to be an awful lot of wrestling in the background, promises made.
On the Republican side, Ewan, there was a bit of embarrassment for John McCain at the hands of Mike Huckabee.
Just to be clear, John McCain will be the Republican nominee, there's no doubt about that. He's so far ahead that, in fact, Huckabee said he didn't major in maths at university, but he did major in miracles. So he's still sort of hoping that he could pull it out. That's just not possible. But it is important because it shows Huckabee's wins in Kansas and Louisiana exposes the sort of rifts in the Republican Party and the unhappiness with lots of Republicans at the prospect of John McCain.
I'm Matt Wells and this is Guardian Daily. Coming up on today's show, an apology for Australia's stolen generation. Plus, a worrying rise in the number of ski and snowboarding accidents this year.
This is an analog signal you're hearing from an avalanche transceiver, which can be put on search and transmit.
Now, it doesn't do fancy graphics or serious games, and this £200 laptop won't earn you the respect of your cutting-edge gadget freak mate. But self-confessed techno-geek Stephen Fry thinks it's the future of computing, and the device has found an unexpected market in schools. RM, the company behind the MiniBook, sold out of its first order of 6,000 within weeks, and it's getting a toehold in a market dominated by Microsoft. So is it true that less is more? We asked Charles Arthur, the Guardian's technology editor, to try it out with the help of his children.
Who made that noise? Use your spacebar to move, and you'll return the key to choose. Hooray!
That's the sound of the RM MiniBook, which is an interesting new development in the whole world of small portable computers. It's got four things going for it that no other laptop has at the moment. It's much cheaper. The price starts at around £170. It's much smaller. It looks like the love child of one of Apple's iBooks and a Nintendo DS handheld console. It's very light. It weighs about a kilogram. And it doesn't run Windows.
No.
RM is aiming it at the education market, but we thought we'd try it out in a home environment with my kids, who range in age from 3 to 10.
I prefer using this smaller computer than the big computer. My favourite programmes are probably doing slideshow. You can kind of draw pictures and you can make kind of these mini presentations for anything.
They're really happy with it. So watching them, what I've realised is that there's a number of things about this machine they really like, particularly the size of the keys. Adult laptops have much larger keyboards, and I think children find it a strain. This is much smaller. Because the screen is only 7 inches across, the machine is scaled to fit. But that actually fits a child's hand much better. They find it much easier to type with. The weight of the machine is another big advantage for them. They can just carry it around from room to room and not worry about breaking their backs. And it's very sensibly laid out. The software is all really easy for them to find. One of the nice things about it is it's completely silent. There's no hard drive, which doesn't mean it doesn't have any storage. It uses what's called flash storage, which is the same as Apple has on a lot of the range of its iPods. And as time goes on, the amount of memory you'll get will grow and grow.
There are a couple of things I find annoying about the computer. One is that the Wi-Fi is quite hard to connect sometimes.
What I've also observed from watching them and trying it out myself is that it's not perfect. The software isn't always as good as you'd like it to be. It's not always child-focused. Another thing I've noticed is that if you turn the machine off or if you suspend it for a while and then restart it, it doesn't always pick up the Wi-Fi network that it was connected to. I think the RM MiniBook is a really promising product. It deserves to do well in the education area, where it's much cheaper than buying a full-size computer. I think for primary school children, it would be a shoo-in, really. But here's the real test, eh? Let's see whether the children want to hang on to it or whether they're glad to see the back of it. OK, kids, shall I take the laptop away then?
Now, it seems that party funding is that issue that just won't go away. This time it's the Tories and Lord Ashcroft, their deputy chairman, who may be causing a bit more trouble for them. Will Woodward, our chief political correspondent, is on the line now.
Yes, it does seem they're still in a bit of a pickle over the Tory deputy chairman. What seems to have happened is that David Cameron, the party leader, has had a word with him about asking him to clarify in public his exact tax position. And it appears the immediate trigger for this is a bill which is being put forward by a Liberal Democrat peer, Lord Oakeshott, who wants to make it illegal for peers to be registered outside Britain for tax reasons, and essentially they're saying that if their peers choose not to register their tax affairs in Britain, then they should no longer be allowed to sit in the upper house. Now, we don't know the full we don't know the full situation with Lord Ashcroft's tax affairs. He's always maintained that any donations he's given to the Tories have been legal. It's clear that he is resident at least part of the year in this country. But whether or not he is fully registered in this country tax-wise is unclear.
Okay, let's stick with the Tories and their warning of a generation of children growing up watching daytime TV. What's all this about?
Yes, the Shadow Work and Pension Secretary, Chris Grayling, has got a rather arresting phrase in a speech today. He says that there is a, quote, Jeremy Kyle generation growing up. I understand he doesn't really mean people sitting around, lazing around in the mornings watching daytime TV so much as the kind of dysfunctional adult you see popping up on the Jeremy Kyle show, you know, regularly. And what he's saying really is that although there's a lot of emphasis on encouraging women and promoting women, and he understands completely that by and large men still control British society, he's saying that that mustn't blind us to problems, particularly I think he's addressing the sort of, if you like, this is an old-fashioned phrase, but the kind of underclass male, that he says they lack role models, they've grown up in a generation of worklessness, and that there's a certain kind of, he doesn't use this phrase exactly, but a certain kind of oikishness on behalf of a lot of young men, which he thinks needs to be addressed.
Okay, well, Woodward, thank you very much. Kevin Rudd, the Prime Minister of Australia, will issue a landmark apology this week to his country's Aboriginal population. Rudd will formally say sorry for the Australian government's policy, which ended in 1970, of forcibly removing thousands of Aboriginal and mixed-race children from their families in a policy of white assimilation. The Guardian's Barbara McMahon is in Alice Springs, where she's been speaking to Zita Wallace, one of the so-called stolen generation.
We had no families. We weren't allowed to ask about our families. We were beaten for speaking our language because none of us could speak English. So our language was beaten out of us. We lost our culture. We lost our identity. We lost our families. We lost our heritage. We actually lost everything. And we were forced to learn the white man's way. And this is done by missionaries.
And how did that make you feel? You must have been very upset and very, very lonely.
I don't think I wasn't lonely because there was a lot of children around. I think there was over 200 children there. I think we sort of bonded, you know, the bonding was there very straight away. And because I had children that spoke the same language as myself and we come from our same culture, I sort of didn't feel too unsafe because I had them. But then when we started to get beaten for speaking our language, we were told that we were heathens and that we were pagans, that we had to learn their way and we had to forget our way. I think then, as I grew older, like from 7 going on to 9, I think then I realised that nothing was ever going to be the same again.
Many decades later, Zita made contact with her mother Nancy, but too many years had passed and it was difficult for them both. After she died, she remained close to her aunt, Aggie Abbott, who has helped her reconnect with her Aboriginal culture. This is Aggie talking in Eastern Arunda language. Zita now lives on her ancestral lands deep in the Australian bush. She has no running water, her television and fridge are run on car batteries, and it's a 100-kilometre journey to Alice Springs. But she says she feels at peace here, unlike many other members of the stolen generation who have been left traumatised and damaged by what happened to them. So how important to you is the fact that the Australian government and Prime Minister Kevin Rudd are going to make a formal apology in Parliament.
For me personally, it's a really big thing because it means that my family and I can move on. All the hurt and the tragedies, I mean, we're a broken people, you know. A lot of our people have no identity. They have no pride in themselves. They've lost that will to survive. They've just given up. They've gotten into drugs and alcohol, and a lot of our youth are killing themselves. Now, with the recognition by the government that we were stolen and that they are apologising on behalf of past governments and policies that this did happen to us, it's admitting to a wrong that was done to us and that the government's prepared to move on with it and assist us in some way, whether it be in compensation or other means. That has yet to be discussed. We're very happy to start with the apology. And yes, it's a really big thing.
A report a decade ago recommended a formal apology to Stolen Generation children, but the previous government under John Howard refused to do so. On Wednesday, the newly elected Labour government will finally say sorry.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
It's only February, but already 30 skiers and snowboarders have been killed this year in the Alps. A number of ski professionals believe this is worryingly high. Yet attempts to educate mountain users in the dangers of going off-piste and the risk of avalanches seem to be falling on deaf ears. Our reporter Robert Booth went to the alpine resort of Val d'Isère to investigate.
Rob, we're looking at the slope angle to see how steep it is, to whether there's a potential avalanche risk.
I'm here 2,500 metres up in the French Alps at Val d'Isère on the Rocher de Balvard. In front of me is a perfect winter playground. But although it looks like an absolute paradise for skiers, this resort has been tinged with sadness this week after Robert Bruce, an anaesthetist from Britain, died when snowboarding off-piste during a conference he was attending here in Val d'Isère. Accounts here in the town suggest that he was with a group and went off on his own to one side to attempt a very difficult drop, which professionals in the town and locals here only try on very limited occasions. The result was that he fell over a drop with rocks beneath him of an estimated 30 metres to his death. A helicopter came very quickly to pick him up, but it appears that there was nothing that could be done to save him. Sadly, he's not alone this winter in the Alps. Already this year, in 2008, it's estimated that at least 29 people have died in skiing and snowboarding accidents across the Alps in Europe, particularly going off-piste.
This is an analog signal you're hearing from an avalanche transceiver, which can be put on search and transmit. And if a victim is taken in an avalanche, the quickest way to find them is using an avalanche transceiver carrying out a self-contained rescue.
I'm James, I'm 27. I'm from Edinburgh in Scotland, and I've been living in Val d'Isère for the last 4 years. I think it's very easy these days for people who haven't necessarily got a lot of mountain knowledge to get into the off-piste. With wide skis and fat snowboards, it's becoming increasingly easy for people who haven't spent a lot of time in the mountains to get into the off-piste. And all the images you see when you're back at home are of people, you know, enjoying the powder. Yeah. I think it's important that if you're coming out here for a week or just on holiday and that you don't know the mountains and you aren't up to date with the current conditions, that you should take a guide, someone who's going to be able to show you not only where to get the best snow, but how to stay safe. Because conditions, what people forget is that although you skied something last year, maybe when you came out on holiday, conditions in the mountains change hour to hour, so you can imagine the difference over an entire season. And so my recommendation would be that you take a guide. I think that it would be unfair to say that people not to do it. If you're capable of doing these things, then I see no reason why you shouldn't be able to do them, but I do think you need to know, not think, that you're capable of doing this stuff.
We've noticed there's a little gully at the bottom where the snow could build up if it went down. And also at the top, there's a little bit of a wind slab, which means that it's a little bit loaded, but we think it's going to be okay. The snow's not super light and fluffy. It's a little bit sun-affected.
Okay, good luck.
Robert Booth reporting from Val d'Isère. That's all for today. I'm back tomorrow for another edition of Guardian Daily. It's ready to listen and download first thing every morning. The producers today were Phil Maynard and Andy Duckworth. I'm Matt Wells. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.